From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This was President Bush last February on the global security threat posed by a nuclear Iran.
And I believe an Iran with a nuclear weapon would be very dangerous for world peace. And have worked with other nations of like mind.
That, of course, was 10 months ago, long before the release on Monday of a new national intelligence estimate, concluding that Iran had suspended its nuclear weapons program in 2003. The news was good, but not necessarily if you're determined to keep voters on constant alert for the unthinkable. It's awkward to keep crying wolf only to produce a couple of yappy Pomeranians. Surely the president would have to pull back on the rhetoric, which not long ago had him imagining World War III. Here he was on Tuesday.
Iran was dangerous. Iran is dangerous. And Iran will be dangerous if they have the knowledge necessary to make a nuclear weapon.
Whatever. That's his story, and he's sticking to it. The media, however, did not. Burned once by this administration's interpretation of intelligence, the press was all over this one.
New report from the nation's intelligence agencies that they do not believe Iran is now working to develop nuclear weapons.
Back now in Studio B with brand new developments on Iran's nuclear program, or lack thereof, I suppose.
The Bush Iran is not developing nuclear weapons after all.
Many of the experts from those agencies that Iran really stopped building nuclear weapons back in 2003.
And the consensus now is nothing short of shocking. The new national intelligence estimate is now saying Iran actually stopped working toward a nuclear weapon back in 2003.
The media dutifully located dissenting voices on the NIE's conclusions, notably Israel's, and did nothing to paper over the nagging question, if the new intelligence consensus is correct, the old one was incorrect, so why trust any of it? But to follow the coverage was to see that the dynamics of the relationship between the White House and the press have seen a turnaround all of their own. The so-called media filter, whom the president had derided as irrelevant to American citizens, once again controls the narrative about Bush's own political and historical relevance. In Tuesday's press conference, for instance, one reporter got under the president's skin by taking note of the president's body language and observing, "You seem somehow dispirited."
You know, kind of psychology 101 ain't working. Just not working, you know?
The reporter was Chicago Tribune White House correspondent Mark Silva. I caught him on his cell phone in Texas and asked, "Why all of a sudden with the Dr. Phil?"
Well, because throughout the press conference, the president was exhibiting a very dour, downbeat manner. He normally comes out, he's ready to go, and he's upbeat and loud and combative. And, you know, he came out, he was soft-spoken, and the more he was asked about the disparities between everything he's been saying and what this report reveals, he just appeared glummer and glummer, if that's a word. And as I sat and listened, it occurred to me that I'd like him to confront why he was in the mood he was in, and it seemed to me related.
In the lead-up to the war in Iraq, the press was, I believe, rightly criticized for being too deferential, too credulous. And equally, it seems to me that over the last few years, the press has pretty much accepted as a given that Iran is, in fact, actively trying to enrich uranium for the purposes of making a bomb. Now comes the new national intelligence estimate, and it turns out that not only was the administration misrepresenting reality, the press, once again, was kind of caught with its pants down. Or am I being too hard on us?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd really agree with that, because there are two situations here. One, Iran has been enriching uranium. The NIE concluded that, you know, that enrichment, in fact, had resumed as of some point in 2006. Now, there's a difference between enriching uranium for civilian nuclear power and for weapons production. It's a difference of magnitude. It's a much lower grade, lower intensity of isotope enrichment that's required for power than it is for a bomb. So the question becomes, what's the motivation? And really the only person arguing the other point of view, which is that it's a civilian nuclear power program for these last few years, has been Ahmadinejad, you know. So I'm not sure that the media is really at fault for misreading this situation. We didn't have the intelligence to know what their motivations were.
There's one aspect of this story that has been covered, but from my personal perspective, it seems to me pretty grossly underplayed. And that was the what did you know and when did you know it question. It's certainly clear that the president was talking about World War III in October when he had already for months been briefed with a short version of the upcoming NIE. Has the administration's feet been held to the fire sufficiently on this question?
Well, the way Steve Hadley, the national security advisor, put it was the president had not been told to, quote, stand down by people within the administration. In other words, there was word from McConnell that, you know, there was a new assessment coming, they needed time to work on it, but nobody had said back off. I suspect at some point was coming up the line the extent of the information. But, you know, you've got to step back and look at what the president is still saying today. I mean, he is still maintaining that Iran is a threat. They're still enriching uranium. So the administration's position today isn't very much different from what the president said in October when he was talking about World War III.
For quite a number of years, the president has been pretty successful at simply avoiding questions that he didn't wish to answer. But in asking him this question about his feelings, asking him the Dr. Phil question, you actually, for one of the first times, created a situation where the president began to sort of unravel.
My interest was trying to get him to get off that programmed path and sort of deal more candidly. He joked that this was like asking Psychology 101, but I would argue that, you know, maybe it was Psychology 101, and he feel very comfortable about all of that. And he also did engage. He generally sort of moves on when he doesn't want to follow up, but he didn't let go. I mean, he and I went back and forth about six or seven times, if you look at the transcript, and I think that's a healthy, good thing in a press conference to get somebody to talk from the heart.
All right, Dr. Mark, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Mark Silva is the White House correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. We caught him in the back of some car as he was covering the Romney campaign in Texas. We've heard the White House transform setbacks into triumphs with a few turns of phrase before, so there was nothing surprising about that aspect of President Bush's press conference this week. But the White House did manage to shock the press corps. Here's CNN's John Roberts.
CNN will have live coverage of the president's news conference beginning at 10 o'clock Eastern. It will be the first time in more than a month that the president will take questions from reporters. It's also the first time I can remember that he gave this much advance notice of a press conference.
U.S. News and World Report's chief White House correspondent Ken Walsh has been covering the White House for over two decades. Can you remember the last time you had this much advance notice before one of President Bush's press conferences?
Been a long time. Usually we get about 45 minutes notice, and often you can't get there in time, especially if you have other appointments that you can't really break. But in this case, we had about a day's notice, and everybody was sort of shocked. I was told today that we shouldn't expect this to be the routine from now on, but they're pleased the way it worked out in this case, and so you might see more of it.
So what changed? Has there been some sort of shift in the way the White House is viewing the press, is choosing to deal with them?
I think there's something of that going on. I think that President Bush, let's just say on the press conference front, he's been holding about one a month, really since the Republicans lost control of Congress. And I think that was a key point because the president in his first term really didn't feel like he needed the media very much because the Republicans have developed this system of communicating with their base directly through email and in other ways. So they're going around the media in quite a sophisticated way. Since the midterms, the White House has felt that they need to try some different things, and part of it is being more engaged with the media.
Well, the correlation with his falling political fortunes is probably inescapable, but he also has a new press secretary, Dana Perino. Maybe this new approach reflects a different style?
Right. There's a definite difference there. Tony Snow, of course, was a conservative commentator before he became White House press secretary on Fox News and on radio. And so he enjoyed doing the daily briefings as sort of a Tony Snow TV show. But he didn't do as much of the private guidance on stories, helping reporters develop stories that other press secretaries had done. Now, Dana Perino was his deputy, and she did do a lot of that. So now that she is the top person, you're getting less of that theater and more of the behind-the-scenes help with stories. But I think that helps both sides, really, because not only does the White House get its point of view out in a more effective way to the media, but also the media gets more of an idea of what the president is thinking and what policies are in stream and how policy is being formulated.
What about the press corps' tone with the president? From this chair, it seems that it was excessively deferential for a long time, but the deference seems substantially to have disappeared. Is that my imagination?
No, well, I don't think it was so much deference as, well, if you go all the way back to 9/11, there was certainly a sense of the media being too much supportive of the administration's policy. As time has gone on, that has eroded, and particularly when the president has seemed at his weakest, this is the way the media work. If there's a sense of weakness or a sense of vulnerability, the watchdog becomes the attack dog. And I think that recently that started to happen as President Bush has been unable to get legislation through Congress. And as the whole political system is moving toward the next president, if you look at the briefings, they're not as well attended as they used to be. So there's that dynamic going on. And so I think you do see perhaps less deference, but also certainly more aggressive questioning and more challenging of his credibility. You saw that in the press conference very clearly, and you see that whenever really he engages on these difficult issues, you get the question of why should we believe the administration, particularly on intelligence matters and other things.
Okay, Ken. Thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
Ken Walsh is the chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report.
Coming up, we revisit our visit to Moscow in the wake of Russia's recent elections.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. According to the Kremlin, parties that support President Vladimir Putin won 72% of the vote last Sunday in Russia's parliamentary elections. A new poll by the independent Levada Center found that more than half of the public would not think worse of Putin if he breached Russia's constitution by running a third time. In fact, 22% said it would actually improve their opinion if he did. Many, including our president, have criticized Putin's iron grip on the media, where opposition voices are effectively banned from the airwaves. Obviously, if you rig election coverage, you're pretty much rigging the election.
Recently, Vladimir Ryzhkov, a former member of Russia's lower legislative body, the Duma, told us that Putin's power, bolstered by petrodollars and political rule changes, is seen as a welcome return to order after Yeltsin-era chaos. That, unlike Yeltsin, he's athletic and sober and a source of national pride.
You know, of course, after humiliation of 90s, when we lost Cold War, when we lost at least half of economy. Of course, people need some pride on Russia, on our country. But question is, what quality of pride? Could we be proud that the top 10 of Russians have incomes 25 times more than lowest 10% of population? Or could we be proud about Russian corruption, which is number one in the world, and last year it was about $300 billion? These topics are not discussed in Russian media. In Russian television, you can see only good news about Russia and only bad news about the West.
To provide some context and perhaps help explain the results of the recent Russian election, we decided to play some excerpts from the show we produced from Moscow in June. Whenever reporters land in foreign capitals, they interview the cab driver. Ours conveniently held the same views as the vast majority of Russians, according to recent polls. Here's what Alexei says.
What do you think of President Putin?
He is a good president. He's done a lot in Russia. Have you seen the program when Putin answered the people's questions on television? He immediately made a decision, and with a single call, he fixed everything.
And it's not a problem that he doesn't really want a free press.
Why? We do have a free press. Everybody says whatever. Here there is no such thing as not being able to say something.
He doesn't want the opposition on the radio or television. Do you think that that's a good thing?
What do you mean by saying not letting the opposition on? You have everything on TV, everything that's possible. And what's forbidden is forbidden.
Moscow may shelter a nest of elitist malcontents, but Alexei speaks for the general public.
Well, what can I do about the public? I don't have other public.
Once, Yevgeny Kiselyov was Russian TV's Walter Cronkite crossed with Ted Koppel. That is, until Kiselyov's boss, the oligarch who launched the hugely popular NTV channel, was prodded by President Putin into voluntary exile. The big pro-Kremlin oil company Gazprom bought NTV and chased all the independent journalists away, among them Kiselyov. He says Russia barely had a chance to get used to openness by the time it was over.
The policy of glasnost started, it has a date. It started in late January 1987. There was a plenum of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union that officially allowed glasnost and abolished censorship, political censorship. Let's say we have 20 years of democratic media history in this country. So what do you expect?
He says journalists have to sell more than their work. They have to sell the idea that their work matters.
We have to face and accept it, that this is the public that we have. We have to stir them up somehow, and if we can, well, it's us to blame, nobody else.
But journalists might be forgiven for laying some of the blame at Putin's door. Boris Yeltsin, for all his fecklessness, did communicate a genuine regard for independent media. Putin conveys contempt. Russian broadcast personality Vladimir Posner was an unofficial Soviet spokesman during the Cold War as a frequent guest on Nightline. After Glasnost, he briefly co-hosted a show with Phil Donahue.
The way the media is treated here, I think, is very cynical. And basically it's that if your newspaper, magazine, whatever, reaches a small number of people and you don't really influence public opinion at all, then you're pretty free to write what you want, and the same applies to radio or to a local television station. But as soon as your outlet reaches a lot of people, especially the so-called federal channels, which is the equivalent of network television in the United States, you only get that information which the powers that be want you to get.
The Russian Union of Journalists, with more than 100,000 members throughout Russia, is getting kicked out of its building.
The thing is that the people who spread all kinds of gossip of what is going on here, they mainly don't care to check their information. They claim that I had wild animals here, but they are all tamed.
The head of the union, Igor Yakovenko, says the building was constructed back in 1980 with funds provided by journalists and that Yeltsin essentially gave it to them. The authorities claim the union is violating the Russian tax code by making improper commercial use of donated space. There's also been some grumbling about the menagerie in Yakovenko's office, the raccoon, the mongoose, the fox, the bunny, a couple of mammals we could neither identify nor translate, and the skunk.
Oh, my God.
Yakovenko says he's going to fight the eviction with all the legal muscle he can muster before the government has a chance to fill part of the building with a TV show called Russia Today. He says it's blatant propaganda. And then he observes, like all the other disgruntled reporters we spoke to, that propaganda and entertainment is all TV offers here. Russian TV journalists may feel a little confined, I said, but at least they don't suffer untimely evictions, do they?
Это правда.
This is true. People are better able to tolerate cages. They get used to them more quickly than animals. Animals are more freedom-loving, less ready to endure captivity. It's true. Maybe that's why I love animals so much.
A couple of flights down, the Center for Journalism in Extreme Situations, started 7 years ago by journalist and historian Oleg Panfilov.
We invented this name because we wanted to help journalists who are planning to work in Chechnya or other wars. But very soon we realized that all Russian journalists are in extreme situations.
Russia is one of the world's most dangerous places for journalists. Since Putin took office, 14 have been murdered for their work, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. After investigative reporter slash human rights activist slash Kremlin critic Anna Politkovskaya was killed in October 2006, Putin told a German newspaper that despite her fame in the West, she was, quote, a person of little influence in Russia. Panfilov remembers the day she was buried on the outskirts of the city, far from public transportation.
It was raining. If you could only see how those hundreds of people walked in the rain, many kilometers, only to say goodbye to Anya.
But was she seen as a victim or a martyr? He said he saw her as both.
Victim because she was killed cruelly, and the martyr because she managed to prove that they were afraid of her. It means that what she was doing was right, and what she was doing was very important.
Politkovskaya worked at Novaya Gazeta, the third reporter at that paper killed under suspicious circumstances related to their work since Putin took office. Igor Domnikov was killed by a fatal blow to the head in 2000. Yuri Shikashikin died of a supposed allergy in 2003. The authorities wouldn't release his medical records, not even to his family, declaring them a medical secret. Novaya Gazeta deputy editor Sergei Sokolov is investigating all their deaths.
For the people who loved us and whom we love, given the general state of modern journalism, I can say only one thing. What is the difference between our official journalists and prostitutes? The women who sell themselves in the streets know who they are and admit it. Journalists also know who they are, but they deny it and call themselves the free press.
If he could change anything about Russia, I asked him, what would it be? The courts, he said. Justice is served only to those with money or power. Andrei Richter is the director of the Moscow Media Law and Policy Center.
It's almost everywhere in this country that you can hire someone to kill your bad husband or bad wife, and people view it almost like street crime, like something which can happen every day. So when we speak about the murder of journalists, we should put it into this wider context.
You're making, you know, Russia, a land of laws, sound like some banana republic.
It is like a South American banana republic, with only condition we don't have bananas, we have oil. But all the rest is about the same.
Russia has a range of legal remedies to settle a dyspeptic press. To oust the Union of Journalists, it's using alleged tax code violations. In a more notorious case, a U.S.-funded NGO that provides training to journalists here, called the Educated Media Foundation, or formerly Internews, was recently closed down. The reason? The director passed through Russian customs last January with a couple of $1,000s in cash she should have declared. She called it a stupid oversight. The Russian authorities responded by seizing the group's computers and freezing its funds, effectively closing it down. But there are other laws specifically designed to chill the media, especially one passed in 2002 called the Law Against Extremism. Andrei Richter.
So the law on extremism makes for the government possible to shut down media organizations if the government, the courts, the prosecutor's office believe that they disseminate political extremism materials. Political extremism materials more and more become an euphemism for political opposition materials.
I always say that freedom of speech is like a corridor.
Again, Vladimir Posner.
It can be a wide one, a narrow one, but there are walls. And if you try to break down those walls, you're going to have a problem. In this case, in Russia today, it's much narrower. It's not censorship in the classic sense of the word. It's to say you don't go to a censor who reads your piece and then puts a stamp on it the way it was in the Soviet Union. But clearly, there are people and subjects that at this time you cannot touch.
Smaller outlets like Novaya Gazeta or the maverick radio station Echo Moskvy, we'll get to that in a minute, don't much worry the Kremlin. But no media outlet of real influence and reach, especially TV, can touch the unofficial opposition. In Putin's managed democracy, there is an official opposition, members of which hold seats in the Duma and even appear fleetingly on TV. But unofficials, like Garry Kasparov, are designated extremist. Posner says he'd like to invite Kasparov on his popular national TV show, but he can't. He can, however, invite the ultra-nationalist newspaper editor Alexander Prokhanov, who was regarded as extremist under Yeltsin. Prokhanov recently called for Russians not to send their biological material abroad, not even for medical tests, because Russia's enemies could use it to create a biological weapon. I had a brief talk with Prokhanov about press freedom.
I believe I heard you say just now that you were a Stalinist and you felt that the Soviet period was the best period for Russia.
You are not mistaken.
I am here. I'm an American journalist here to report on the state of freedom of speech in Russia today. What do you have to say to somebody like me?
In the Soviet period, I felt I was totally free. KGB did not follow me. I was a very successful writer. After the Soviet Union collapsed and the era of real freedom started, when freedom of speech occurred, when liberals came to power, and when press was called the Fourth Estate, we lost our freedom of speech. Great writers and journalists who were very close to me were deprived of their right to appear on TV screens. We felt like we lived under a plastic cap. Now the situation has begun to change. In the Putin era, liberals who once had great access to the media are being pushed into the background, and people of my views, who believe in a strong Russian state and centralized control over the economy and culture, have more and more opportunities. My new newspaper, which I started after my old paper Day was shut down, is called Tomorrow. It has no difficulties, either legal or financial. All the TV channels constantly invite me, the Stalinist and Russian state supporter. So how can I claim after all that in Putin's Russia there is no freedom of speech?
You are a welcome guest on the first channel. Does it bother you that, for instance, Garry Kasparov is not?
No,
it does not bother me. Because there was a time when Garry Kasparov was a welcome visitor at all the channels, and my absence did not bother him. It doesn't even bother me that during the dissenters' march, the police clubbed Garry Kasparov's allies. It doesn't bother me at all, because at other times my friends were beaten nearly to death during our rallies. They shot at us from tanks and machine guns, and people like Garry Kasparov never bothered to stand up for us.
Is this then a matter of more speech now, or simply different speech?
Of course it's a different freedom of speech. Russia is a country where freedom of speech first belongs to some, and they shut the others' mouths, and then freedom of speech passes to the others, and the first ones have to keep their mouths shut. Such is the Russian peculiarity.
Radio Echo Moscow.
Prokhanov appears once a week on Echo Moskvy, a radio station he admires, even though he says it's his ideological enemy. One of the most popular stations in Moscow, Echo Moskvy slams Putin with stunning regularity, breaking the law on extremism practically on the hour. It's a puzzle no Russian media watcher can solve. How can it do what it does, owned as it is by the solidly pro-Kremlin Gazprom, the oil company that broke the back of the once freewheeling NTV channel, the very emblem of vibrant Yeltsin-era media. Now with NTV firmly under the thumb of the Kremlin, its old journalists are running for cover at, you guessed it, Echo Moskvy. Why is it still on the air? Few even venture a guess, except Echo Moskvy talk show host Yevgeny Kislyov.
The biggest reason is that in the eyes of the Kremlin, we are not a leverage of political influence. That's number one. Number two, we do not represent any kind of major threat to what is now euphemistically called stability. Number three, they can always shut us down, and they know that. And number four, they need a showcase. They need a window decoration, so to say. When you American guys come here, your politicians, your public figures come here to start talking about, well, violations of the freedom of the speech, they say, well, wait. We have Echo Moskvy. And they are allowed to criticize everyone, to ask most difficult questions, and all the opposition figures are there day and night, so what are you talking about?
I asked if he thinks he'll ever get out of his gilded cage at Echo Moskvy.
I'm quite sure of that, because sooner or later, the situation in the country will change. It cannot last forever. Of course, we don't know who are the next leaders, and probably in 4 years from now or in 8 years from now, we'll be nostalgically reminiscing about the gold days of Vladimir Putin's liberal presidentship.
Nostalgia of all sorts is a frequent theme here. Even nostalgia for the good old, bad old days of fighting to be heard. Actually, that may be, in Prokhanov's phrase, the real Russian peculiarity.
Coming up, one Russian editor explains why the West should butt out.
And why Bob thinks Comcast must die. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, offering a new one-year Master of Arts degree program for experienced journalists. Journalism.columbia.edu. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In this next interview, which Brooke recorded last June in Moscow, we hear the candid views of a Russian editor who is sick and tired of Western pieties about a free press.
When you're representing an American radio program called On the Media, and you say you want to talk about free speech, pro-Kremlin media heavyweights will cross the street to avoid you. Aside from Alexander Prokhanov, who in the last segment laid out an extreme position even by Russian standards today, we couldn't find anyone of importance, by which I mean a player, willing to sit down with us and explain the Kremlin's position. Except one, Vladimir Mamontov, editor-in-chief of one of the nation's most important, most famous, most emblematic newspapers, Izvestia. Izvestia started out as a revolutionary paper in 1917, but soon became an organ of the government. It was Stalinist under Stalin, and then it grew more liberal during the thaw of Nikita Khrushchev. In the late 80s and into the 90s, it was in the forefront of perestroika. And in 2005, it was purchased, as was so much of Russian media, by the state-owned oil company Gazprom. Its liberal editor was sent packing to be replaced by former Komsomolskaya Pravda deputy editor Vladimir Mamontov. Liberals have bemoaned what they see as the paper's devolution into a Kremlin mouthpiece. Mamontov, obviously, sees it differently.
Nowadays, as editor-in-chief of Izvestia, I want to see it as a definitely conservative, definitely pro-government newspaper, and there is no desire on my part to conceal that. It seems to me that it is within the boundaries of the freedom of speech to follow this line, and I think those people who inform you that there is something wrong with Izvestia are, in fact, exactly the people who want to monopolize the very notion of freedom of speech and who do not want to tolerate any opinion different from their own. So they are eager to label other heterodox newspapers as yellow press or pro-Putin or KGB-dependent publications. These shallow allegations, I hear them every day.
My question is how you make your decisions, what red lines you have at your paper. In other words, we know what's happened to television under Gazprom. Gazprom is becoming a media empire which is very closely associated with Putin. If there isn't any explicit censorship, the feeling is that there is probably some self-censorship.
The thing is that I have my own independent political views formed throughout my life. And in order to live by them, express them, or use them as the guidelines in my editorial policy, I do not need either Gazprom or Putin. It has been my understanding for a long period of time that Russia should be strong, should use its advantages, and so on.
But I wonder, as a journalist, what do you think of Putin's policies regarding a free press in Russia?
I think that during the Yeltsin years, the press was handled mostly by oligarchs like Berezovsky and Kuczynski, and they managed Russian media outlets in the way that it would suit them. It was not until Putin became the president that this way of thinking was interrupted. Instead, there have been created official TV networks, which, as is practiced in many countries in the world, hold a very well-balanced, cautious, and absolutely pro-government position. There are lots of presidents like this all over the world. The difference is only in the mastery of disguise. And our networks might be too straightforward, not sophisticated enough. At the same time, you can't underestimate the role of these TV stations in stabilizing situation in society. Undoubtedly, they do that using a range of methods, like filtering of information, entertainment programming. All in all, it would be really strange to deny that, to a certain extent, our TV networks function in propaganda mode. At the same time, I should tell you that having traveled a lot through many countries, I do not remember a single case when the major TV station would be in opposition to the government.
Is it because you feel Russia is so fragile that it can't handle opposition on mainstream television?
As soon as we establish a secure and predictable multi- or bipartisan system, and after we have lived with it for several years, I will totally agree with you and would root for all kinds of opposition. I would not be concerned with the fragility of Russia anymore. You have asked me if I consider the economical, political, or any other part of Russian life to be unstable. I'd say I do not understand how I can live without this fear of instability if I have lived the major part of my life being the communist, then found myself in the midst of perestroika, then lived through tumultuous 1990s.
Почему же я должен...
How can I be sure that the situation in Russia will be stable from now on without me personally contributing to this stabilization? I saw how easily things break apart and replace one another. Those irreversible changes happen not always based on the needs or agreement of the majority. Not at all. There were lots of outside factors, political forces. I saw all this happen with my own eyes, saw how political methods work. I still witnessed similar scenarios played out.
Do you think, given this point in Russia's history, it's all right for the president or the government to control the principal means by which people get information in this country, television?
Can you show me any country where the sources of mass information are not controlled? Same things happen all over the world. The political force in power manages the way information is distributed. I do not want to expose my colleagues from Western media who are quite frank with me in describing how it all works in states. Who is calling from where, how the problems are taken care of, how the interaction with the government is structured. The only way out of this situation is to have different journalist publications and media outlets coming from the opposing political parties. So just give us the time and we'll create those opposing forces, normal political parties. You do not have those extremists that we do, apart from the so-called political party of anti-globalists that break the windows. We have our freaks, you have yours. I am very sure that all these mechanisms will emerge and develop in Russia. And by the way, it'll happen much faster with your assistance. It would be, in fact, nice to receive some encouragement instead of the streams of criticism that serve as a better evidence of Western journalists' ignorance and inability to comprehend the situation in Russia than of anything else.
But do you sympathize at all with the concern that this control of Russian television smacks of the past, of the Cold War? You say that you are an ex-communist, but that said, you wouldn't want to go back to that time. Do you see why people might be worried about that?
I can assure you that not a single sensible individual in Russia wants to get back to USSR. I do not see any serious signs of totalitarian regime here. Totalitarianism is very serious and has nothing to do with what's happening. Our citizens are free to go wherever they want, film what they want, stage their plays on any subject they want. Our cinemas show their motion pictures all over the world. Anything can get published. Internet is not banned or blocked. You ask me if I want to go back. Well, being a person with keen interest for Western music, Western literature, I do not want to go back. Instead, I want to integrate my new interests with my love for Russian literature and many facets of Soviet life as well.
By the way, there are absolutely anti-Putin plays that are on in the theaters all over the
country.
Only not on TV.
That's separate.
But you can't integrate culture without politics. Politics can never be left aside.
Just pay attention to this curious phenomenon for a moment. Among all the imaginable freedoms our people have, mobility, right to work, and all the freedoms that I talked about a couple of minutes before, you somehow concentrate only on those freedoms that have their shortcomings, that are in some ways limited. Why do you not blame EU for not giving Russian citizens open-date visas? This way, our people could travel more and consequently learn from the Western democratic experience. Let's focus on this problem as well. I just see that you have a tendency to select a certain point and devote all of your attention to it. And I can detect a certain bias in this approach.
So true, but our program is called On the Media. However, one could easily extrapolate that from freedom of speech, freedom of the press, emerges all freedoms, ultimately freedom of thought.
I am sometimes smitten by your Western self-confidence. You are somehow sure that everything you say, all the values you propagate, be they true or false, are ultimately good and indispensable for everybody. But, my dear friends, it's so much not right. I'll reiterate, it's not true. There are different civilizations who created their own values, and Russia is one of them. You can't point to us which freedom is more important and to which extent it has to be presented. We might as well figure it out ourselves. We do not ever try to dictate to you the rules of the game. This problem is actually at the root of everything else. Gentlemen, just let us have our own values. Do not put this mercy on us by force, as you do in Iraq, in Serbia. Whenever the due progress is not achieved, you use your military force, bombs, air force. Why don't you start with yourself and deal with your own Bush? Everybody says Russian journalists are in danger, but look at what's happening in Iraq. How many journalists and people were killed there? Thousands of people have been murdered. Why were those people killed? What did they suffer for? In fact, they suffered for democratization, according to the rules you consider to be superior and true. Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Vladimir Momentov is the editor of Izvestia. So, Bob.
Brooke.
We cover the media here, right? Sometimes we cover cable. Sometimes we cover Comcast. And sometimes we nail our guests for conflicts of interest. So, Bob, what's the deal with this new website you founded called ComcastMustDie.com?
I happen to be a Comcast customer. I happen to be writing a book about how across a vast number of institutions in the economy and society, the internet is changing everything, essentially by ending a world in which we can be as consumers and citizens dictated to and opening up a world in which the consumer is very much in control of his own destiny. I had it very much in mind the day that I had some problems getting my Comcast Triple Play service, that's phone, internet, and TV, all bundled into the same package. And I won't bore you with the details, but it was a nightmare, including vast hold times, including a lot of broken promises and everything else.
So are you using your highly coveted, profoundly influential position of co-host of this program to solve your personal cable problem?
Well, it's a question, of course, I asked myself, not only as the co-host of On the Media, but also as a critic of advertising for Advertising Age, which also covers Comcast. I have a blog on Ad Age. It is the means by which I'm writing this book. In effect, I'm using the very principles of what I call listenomics to...
Patent pending?
Yes, patent pending. I'm using the very principles of listenomics to get the kind of feedback from readers that I think politicians and corporations must learn to get from their own customers and voters. And I posted a blog item, which I thought had the catchy title of Comcast Must Die. And it was about my experience, but mainly it was asking other consumers about the idea of forming an e-surrection against companies that treat us like dirt. That's how I rationalized my decision, not trying to extort Comcast into solving my personal problem, but trying to extort Comcast into solving every customer's problems. Of course, every phone company and every cable company has a large number of people who are really angry with them.
Now, the show recently did an interview that was critical of Comcast's practice of cutting off lengthy uploads. Don't you think it'll hurt our credibility as, you know, a fair broker in this if you've got a website called Comcast Must Die?
Well, I'm afraid it does actually undercut our credibility, which is why I, of course, am going to recuse myself from anything that our show does with respect to Comcast. Happily enough, when you did that interview, I was like in Estonia or, you know, somewhere in the Baltics.
But the thing is that even though you aren't doing the interviews, you are, in fact, you know, very much identified with this program. And doesn't it give the On the Media imprimatur to your endeavor?
Well, I hope it doesn't. I'm certainly not representing On the Media, WNYC, NPR, Advertising Age, or anyone else, but my own quest to drag this particular company kicking and screaming into the digital age. And, you know, Brooke, the evidence is, in some very substantial ways, they are coming around. For example, as far as I know, everyone who has posted his or her customer number along with their complaint on this website has gotten immediate follow-up from Comcast to resolve the problem. And many of them have written back to the blog to say, you know, it's kind of amazing, but not only did they do it, but it's actually changed their way of looking at Comcast. Gee, my website has been open for 2 months, and I don't know how many tens of thousands of page views I've had, but I've had more than 1,200 comments, people taking the trouble to go to their keyboard and unburden themselves.
I should say for the record that you did not request this interview. I wanted to do it as a matter of full disclosure.
I did not want to be talking about Comcast on our show. It's just the conflict of interest issues are swirling already. I just didn't want to make them worse. But it's really nice, I got to tell you, being interviewed by Brooke.
Bob Garfield is a columnist for Ad Age and co-host of On the Media.
Hanging around downtown by myself, and I had so much time.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Buolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Jessica McGowdy and Ian Whitehead. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
One last thing. Technical director Dylan Keefe. He's a former rock star. Actually, for 7 years, he's been OTM's personal rock star. And now he's leaving, going to a new national morning show to be launched by this station in early spring.
You might have heard him. His voice has popped up in voiceovers and skits, including this one recently when he read one of our 12-word novels.
There are no atheists in foxholes, said the chaplain, so get out.
He picked that one.
But more importantly, he's picked out most of those little musical interludes that help make the show sonically and emotionally coherent. In fact, Dylan has been a master of creating graceful and sometimes profound connections between two different stories and two disparate moods.
And regular listeners know we've made no secret of how much we edit the program. A single interview can contain 100 edits, 1,000 edits go into every single show. Dylan is the guy who makes sure you can't hear them. That takes him all night, every Thursday night, from roughly sunset to roughly sunrise, depending on the season.
Then there are his ideas, which come from voracious reading and journalistic rigor that comes from God knows where, certainly not us. And he is the world's greatest guy, and we are just going to miss him. Although, as far as I'm concerned, the traitor is dead to me!
Dylan's a bass player, you know, and it's his bass line, that steady thrum that propels the show, both on the air and behind the scenes. We're going to have to find a new one now.
Catcher Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Ladies and gentlemen, for our purposes, Dylan Keefe has left the building.
Support for WNYC is provided by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting Red Hot Holiday Stomp with Wynton Marsalis, Esapatha Merkerson, and friends on December 10th. Hosted by Glenn Close. Check local PBS listings. Support for On the Media is provided by the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, offering a new one-year Master of Arts degree program for experienced journalists. journalism.columbia.edu. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.